Lisboa,
Bruxelles,
Varsava.
This podcast has been produced in cooperation with Euronet Plus, the leading radio network for EU news.
But this podcast would not be possible without the incredibly generous support of our amazing listeners who donate a little bit each month at patreon.com/Europeans Podcast. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Europeans podcast, where we poke our microphones into the corners of Europe you didn't hear about nearly enough. My name is Dominic Kramer, and we're here with something different, something you're probably not expecting because, yeah, partly because we're in the middle of a mini-series, but also because we usually don't do breaking news. We're more of a reflective, slow news kind of podcast. But we're here today interrupting that release of our mini-series, Who Does It Best, because our producer, Wojciech Oleksiak, is in a place this week where a big protest movement is creating international headlines. I guess we could almost describe this as Who Does It Best, protest edition. Wojciech, hello.
Hi, Dominik. Zdravo.
I understand you're not at home in Warsaw, but somewhere a good 1,000 kilometers south. Where exactly are you?
So currently I'm in the capital city of Serbia, Belgrade, but I just got back from Serbia's second largest city, Novi Sad.
Right, and Novi Sad is the place where there was this massive protest on Saturday.
Well, protest might not even be the right word here. It was more of a commemorative rally for the victims of the disaster that happened exactly a year ago. Either way, it was one of the biggest gatherings I've ever seen in my life. And trust me, I've been to some huge demonstrations before.
I saw that official reports put the number of participants at around 40,000, but yeah, that, I guess, is probably a very conservative estimate. For those not familiar with what's going on and why people are collecting in the streets in large numbers, can you quickly explain what happened a year ago and what made you decide to go to Novi Sad?
Yeah, sure. But before I talk about this specific event, I think it's important to give some of the political context. So Serbia has followed a pattern we've seen before, a pattern used by right-wing populist parties in countries like Hungary, my home country Poland, Slovakia, Georgia, to some extent you could say in Bulgaria. So in Serbia, SNS, the Serbian Progressive Party, and its leader Aleksandar Vučić have ruled for over a decade. And I think that by looking at what's happening in Serbia, we can find out a lot about the nature of this political ideology and what happens when it actually governs a country and for a long time.
Okay, so what is this pattern and what exactly is the flavor of Serbian illiberal democracy?
So look, for Serbia, it started with an economic crisis. Think back to 2008. Life got really hard. People were frustrated and wanted some change. So they elected a center-rightish party, mildly populist, that promised to fix things, bring foreign investments, etc. And to be fair, it sort of delivered. Not everything was perfect, but life improved a bit. Public sector salaries went up, inflation slowed, people were likely to get some new social benefits for them or their family. Like, you know, this kind of minor improvements.
Okay, minor improvements, but what was the not-so-perfect part?
That was the moment Vučić and SNS started feeling strong support. After consecutive terms, they started gobbling up the state piece by piece and treating it like their own private estate.
I guess gobbling up the state is your Wojciech way of saying what political scientists would refer to as state capture.
Yes, exactly. I'm no political scientist, so that's the language I use. But you know what I mean is that under the cover of necessary reforms, like restoring justice, restoring national pride, or some other vague ideal, they gradually took over public media, then private media. They packed courts and tribunals with loyal judges. They installed their people at the top of every possible institution. And you know, corruption, nepotism, cronyism, paired with lack of any accountability for all the scandals being uncovered, all this makes Serbians feel like they're living in a country where wherever you turn, the ruling party is there. people feel like the country doesn't belong to them anymore, but to the party itself. And that was very much my experience living under law and justice in Poland. It's what I'm hearing from my friends in Hungary too.
So would you say that Vucic and SNS have offered a promise of prosperity, but at the expense of kind of the core functioning of liberal democracy?
Yeah, it was a bit like, we'll give you prosperity and economic growth, and in return, you don't ask too many questions about what's happening behind the scenes. So, you know, even when a major corruption scandal wasn't covered, and there was quite a few of them in the recent decade, a lot of people just waved it off, saying, oh, they're still better than before, than Boris Tadic. At least there's less unemployment and the economy is a bit better. Also, Vucic is a very skillful player internationally. He's maintaining good terms with both the EU and Russia, and this is very important for Serbians.
I guess you could argue that this is also how Putin's Russia started out, too.
Yeah, I think it's a good point. And in Serbia, the arrangement worked for many years. Enough people were fine with it that the country remained relatively stable. But, you know, as with an apple, you live out too long, things started to rot. And it's a one-way process, really. So, you know, the corruption, propaganda, and the lack of accountability became unbearable, and people began protesting a few years ago. The problem was President Aleksandar Vucic proved incredibly good at outlasting them. He mastered this tactic of dragging things out, discrediting, dividing, and taming any real political opposition. And when I talked to my Serbian friends about 15 months ago, most of them felt like it was game over, that they just completely ran out of options, that no one was left who could genuinely represent those unhappy with the country's backsliding.
And then came this awful railway station catastrophe.
Yeah, exactly a year ago, on November 1st, part of the roof of Novi Sad's newly renovated railway station collapsed, burying 16 people underneath. And this renovation was a part of one of the key projects of building a high-speed railway linking Belgrade and Budapest. It was also massively important locally because a lot of people who live in Novi Sad work or study in Belgrade, so thousands are commuting between the cities every day. But as we discussed in an episode this summer called Is Real Change Coming to Serbia, the country has a history of carrying out infrastructure projects in a way that makes their political class richer, sometimes with the backing of the Chinese government, which was also the case here. The renovation was paid for in part by China's Belt and Road Initiative. So the catastrophe, it really marked a turning point in Serbia's recent history. But I have to admit, having followed events in Serbia for quite a while, the tragedy had almost become this reference point I mentioned automatically when talking about the country. I stopped really thinking about what it meant to people who lived through it until I stood in front of the station 2 days ago. And then after I spoke to Mila Dragnic, who is an almost graduated student and a freelance journalist from Novi Sad.
I saw it on social media. That's the first time. My friend sent me a reel of it, the video of it falling. And I was kind of shocked. I first thought it's kind of embarrassing to admit it. I like laughed because I was like, of course, whatever the Serbian Progressive Party built, it's going to collapse. But the second was like, were there people underneath it?
Mila was asked by her colleague to rush to the station and take some photos.
At that point, already police had forbid people from getting closer, so you could only be, let's say, 50 meters close. There were cranes. I saw they were taking someone out. I was just standing there, and I took my pictures, I sent them, but even after that, I just stood there for 30 minutes in silence and just kind of watched it. And I kind of looked around at other people, and you can see they were just kind of just hoping that for the best, because you can see that clearly people have died. At that time, we didn't know a number. We didn't know how bad was it. We didn't really know anything. Complete silence. It was very silent. I was a bit crying. It was, you know, just tears kind of running down my face. And there was this feeling of helplessness and shock. And it was, I remember that day crystal clear. From that point, I remember getting to my apartment, you know, texting with people, seeing if I can find anything out.
Soon, we learned that 16 people had died and one person was severely injured, losing three of their limbs.
And then in the evening, there was a commemorative gathering as well in Novi Sad. I took photos of it. It was also very silent. And just, that was a day that shifted Novi Sad, definitely. And I don't think this city has been the same ever since.
And it wasn't just Novi Sad that changed. The tragedy sparked a wave of protests unlike anything Serbia had seen under President Vucic and his party SNS. Here's Filip Đorđević, who's a newly graduated journalist, a correspondent for Deutsche Welle, and a good friend of mine. We went to Novi Sad together.
That somehow made people feel like the corruption isn't this abstract thing, that it doesn't bother you, that doesn't bother your pocket. This is like me, you, anybody else could be under that canopy. I went there to that train station a couple of times. People went there like every single day. It could be any of us.
The weeks following the fall of the canopy, I found myself just like looking up to see whether, you know, if the construction I'm walking underneath, if it's everything is fine. And I think everyone from Novi Sad is doing that to make sure nothing will fall on them. And it was a bizarre thing, and I think everyone was doing it.
A lot of the protests before were about something, let's say, in a really abstract way. Like, they were fighting for democracy, they were fighting against corruption, the same messages, but still there wasn't any specific agenda or problem that people can unite on.
The protests that followed the collapse were very different from the previous ones. At first, they were very apolitical. The only demand was for the ruling party to release full documentation about the station renovation and to hold those responsible to account. There was no political leaders in front. It was just students who started organizing 24-hour blockades of the university buildings, then public institutions, roads and bridges, marching across the country, talking to people, trying to wake them up.
Yeah, I have to say I was quite amazed seeing these headlines and seeing these stories of students like pretty much shutting down the country a couple of times. And on the other hand, I find myself thinking, these are just students. Like, they should be studying. They should be doing all the student things. And yeah, it's great that they're doing this protesting, but it must be taking such a toll on them all.
Oh, it completely reshaped the lives of everyone I spoke to. Mila, Filip, and many people I chatted with informally, you know, when the recorder wasn't running. Here's Filip again.
I actually quit my work just to finish my studies. And then the protest started. I couldn't finish my studies in the time I wanted. And then I had to find some work to do. And I tried everything, and I was on so much protest that was going on. This year has been a really decisive.
When most people entered the blockades, there was this high, and there was this, you know, need for justice and need for a better country, because what would a university degree even mean in this type of society? But as the months went on, for almost a year, there were no exams, there were no classes. Some students I've spoke to, they're burnt out because they had a very, very insane year of a lot of protesting, a lot of being outside, a lot of planning. You know, even though they, let's say, didn't have regular classes, they were still active 24/7. I think it's very chaotic for them right now.
Basically, it was a really challenging year with new challenges that nobody learned me how to overcome, which you just have to find out for yourself how to overcome. Nobody can suggest you with something that has happened for the first time in 50, 60 years. Nobody can recommend you all do that. No, you need to figure something out for yourself.
And months into the protest, which really shook the country and drew in more people than ever before, the movement began to take a more political turn. It was a major shift, because first they wanted the people actually responsible to be put behind bars. But seeing how Vucic is trying to water it down, how he's refusing to collaborate with his people and that, they now want him and the SNS gone first, and only then do they want to sort out everything else.
That's their only demand right now, and the idea is to create a transitional government made out of the non-political people who are going to fix the problems with rigged elections, that are going to fix the judiciary system, and who are also going to investigate the fall of train station properly.
So is the idea that the students who are protesting, that they would actually be running in these election whenever they end up happening?
No, they won't. They haven't published candidate lists yet, but those lists are set to include widely respected apolitical experts. These people aren't meant to become a new political elite. Their role would be to guide the country through a short transitional period, to loosen the ruling party's grip on institutions, hold those responsible for the deaths accountable, and then call new, fairer elections. And since summer, every protest has carried this central message. We want snap elections.
I remember you telling us in previous episodes about Serbia that Vucic loves elections. He's won every one of them pretty easily in recent years, both as president and prime minister. Why isn't he willing to call one now?
Well, apparently at this point, he used to love elections. He's very clearly unsure of whether he'd be able to continue his winning streak, I think. Going into Saturday's protest, the feeling was a bit of fatigue, yes, but the protesters also had one clear demand, snap elections, and there was also a real sense of excitement about how big the rally could get. I arrived the day before in Belgrade and was supposed to take the train to Novi Sad with Filip.
And why are we on the bus, not on the train?
Oh, we are on the bus because our president said, President Vucic said that the trains had bombs in it, and so we couldn't go with the train. And unfortunately, we were forced to take a bus and to leave Belgrade 3 hours later than we would have hoped for.
On the eve of the protest, Vucic went on national television to apologize for the way he'd talked about students and protesters, the many names he'd called them over the past year. But conveniently, all trains were suddenly cancelled from the day before the protest until 3 days after, just to make everyone's life harder and stop some people from coming.
That's a really cheap shot.
Right? Still, we and thousands of other people managed to get there the night before. And through the night, people in Novi Sad were welcoming students who had marched from every corner of Serbia. Some of them had walked for days, even hundreds of kilometers. The group I talked to, at least 4,000 people strong, had walked from Belgrade for 2 days, covering over 40 kilometers a day. That's like, you know, walking a marathon every day, but in a group of 4,000 people.
Wow, that's impressive.
It was incredibly tough, but I think the welcome they got in Novi Sad was worth it. They were welcomed like heroes.
Pumpai, what does that mean?
It means pump it, as in keep up the pressure. It became the slogan of these protests, a call to keep pushing the government as hard as possible.
That is a great slogan.
Isn't it? I love it. So the atmosphere that night was loud, you know, joyful, energetic, all whistles and chants. But the next morning, on November 1st, everything turned 180 degrees. From early in the morning, people gathered quietly in front of the railway station, lighting candles, bringing flowers. There were hushed voices, long hugs, quiet contemplation, and by around 10 a.m., the crowd was so huge, you couldn't see its end in any direction. I climbed up on a structure just to see, but all I could see was a sea of people. The atmosphere was so heavy that the only question I felt I could ask was...
Can I ask you, how do you feel today?
A little bit sad because of this tragedy that happened last year, and full of hope because of these students that were walking last days to Novi Sad, and students give us a hope that there is a chance that things will be better in future.
I really like your shirt. Can you tell me what's written here?
Together we stand, divided we fall.
That mix of sadness and hope, it's something I heard again and again.
As we students say, we're all under the canopy. Every day we are witnessing the horrors that this country is committing, that this government is committing, because every part of Serbia, every small town, every big town, every village suffers in its own way.
Do you feel some kind of tiredness that is lasting so long?
No and yes. No, because these moments right here refill you. They give you hope. They give you encouragement to continue on fighting.
What struck me most was how young many of them were, early 20s, and yet how deeply they felt responsible for the future of their country.
We don't want to live in this kind of environment, this kind of nation, and in this kind of world. We want a better place, not just for us, but like for children that are gonna come and stay and live in Serbia, because if this continues, nobody's gonna stay here.
And then the official commemoration began. At 11:52, the exact time of the catastrophe, the entire crowd fell silent. 16 minutes of complete silence, one for every victim, 40,000 people or more, and complete silence. I've never experienced anything like that. It was more powerful than any roar a crowd like that could make. The only thing you could hear were the drones hovering above us, filming. And was there a moment that was like specifically memorable or emotional for you?
Oh, the 16 minutes of silence, especially that because of the song that was playing. So basically, the song says everything's same in my neighborhood, but I'm just not there. Which is really emotional because everything stayed the same, but these 16 people are not here. And like, I saw a lot of people crying. I almost cried, and even though I should stay focused.
After that came a few speeches, including one from Diana Hrka, the mother of one of the victims. And she said, open quote, "I need to know who killed my child, who killed 16 people. Someone must be held responsible for this. I will go on a hunger strike in front of the city assembly tomorrow." End quote. So her plan was to continue the hunger strike until elections are called and justice is served. When I went back into the crowd, people were visibly shaken. I didn't even dare to approach anyone for at least like 30 minutes after that. Gradually, very slowly, the atmosphere was getting a bit less tense, so I resumed my interviews.
Can I ask you, how are you feeling today?
I'm feeling very emotional and disturbed. I remember the pain in the voice of a mother whose son tragically died or was murdered here on that first November.
Later, I finally convinced someone a bit older to talk to me. There was this couple in their 50s. They were among the older faces in the crowd.
The question is very simple today. How are you feeling?
Sad. Emotional. Very emotional.
Very sad.
I was crying a lot, sorry. Cautiously optimistic.
So you're optimistic because do you think that there is a chance that such protests like this can really change something?
Like I said, there's always a chance. Just don't give up, especially when it's the hardest. Like these students walked 16 days, so they never gave up. And now even when the government shut the water down in the city, we are still here, we are still fighting. So nothing they can do will stop our spirit. The question is what's going to happen next, what's coming next.
The government cut off the water.
So for 2 or 3 hours, most of Novi Sad had no water. I'm not here to judge whether that was intentional or not, but what I can say is that the public water management company from Novi Sad said that this water shut off was due to a power outage. Still, what that man in his 50s said to me stayed with me.
And they cling to power is so strong, without violence, they never step down.
And that was something I heard a few times, not just at the protest, but later in bars and cafes. There's a sense of deep frustration that it's all dragging on for so long, that Vučić refuses to meet their demands. The next day in Belgrade, there was a tense standoff between protesters and police guarding the parliament and the tents set up by Vučić supporters. It couldn't have been more different from the solemn, almost majestic demonstration in Novi Sad.
Bravo!
It was loud, angry, chaotic, people shouting, fireworks going off. I saw maybe 5 policemen at the rally in Novi Sad, just all volunteers and veterans looking after it being peaceful and orderly. And here there were hundreds blocking every street around the parliament. Philip told me this had been happening almost every night in August. Some of the aggression, he said, came from the pure exhaustion and frustration. Many people that night were visibly on edge, and later when I left, there were some scuffles with the police and 37 people got arrested.
Well, I'm just glad no one got seriously hurt and that it didn't turn into one of those brutal crackdowns we saw earlier in the summer. But tell me, Wojciech, what's come out of all of this? Vucic did make an announcement about elections, didn't he?
He did, sort of. He said something vague, typically for him. The elections would be called, open quote, ahead of the schedule, and that relevant institutions would decide on the exact date, end quote. Not sure what he meant by that, because he is the power to dissolve the National Assembly and call early elections. And also, nobody I spoke to had any idea what that actually meant. But the bottom line is, you can't ignore a crowd like the one that filled Novi Sad on Saturday. The situation feels ripe, and it's clearly high time for elections to be declared.
Everybody has their own position, and they are not undecided voters.
Filip told me that nobody in Serbia is changing their mind anymore. There are 2 camps, one clinging to power for survival and the other determined to bring change.
For example, I can't change whatever facts I show the SNS voter, I can't change his opinion, as well as he can't change mine currently. Even though I'm really open for it, I would really like to hear some good arguments. Honestly, if he showed me the best argument, I would be still like, no, I disagree. And like, I think that's how the people function right now.
So, Wojciech, what's your biggest takeaway from your days in Serbia? You said at the start that you saw patterns, that this wasn't an isolated case.
Yeah, so Serbia's story says a lot about how far impunity can stretch in politics, especially in countries where democracy has been eroded. How long can you hold on to power that came from free elections if you've angered your citizens so deeply that most of them want you gone? And like, it really, really struck me when talking to people how similar this was to what we experienced in Poland, especially towards the end of the second term of Law and Justice. They felt so invincible that they really started treating the country's resources and assets as their party's own. And now that we voted them out, 2 years later, no one's behind bars. No one's really in trouble, and they've done plenty of unconstitutional things. They were knee-deep in corruption by the end. Is that how democracy and the rule of law are supposed to work? Not sure about that.
Well, more accountability would certainly do no harm.
Right. And, you know, then you look at the country like Georgia, where peaceful protests are being met with brutal crackdowns and arrests, like, just as we speak. It's a similar story, but it's playing out in a different, darker way. But in all of these cases, my personal take is that we won't restore the conviction in people that democracy is something incredibly important if we don't put more effort into making sure that accountability is a foundation of, you know, of how we operate, how we move from one government to another. And for Serbia specifically, at least for now, everything is still up in the air. But I can't help rooting for this movement. It's incredibly inspiring to see people in their 20s push a leader like Vucic up against the wall, like forcing him to say things he'd never say otherwise and giving him a really, really hard time. It's hopeful, deeply hopeful. And even though these few days were full of heavy emotions, I'll really go back home feeling more optimistic than when I arrived here.
Well, I'm so glad to hear that from you, Wojciech. Thank you so much for going to Serbia and finding out what was happening on the ground for us. If this was Who Does It Best protests across Europe, I definitely think the Serbian students would be up there as one of the top protest movements and one of the most effective protest movements. So have safe travels home, Wojciech. And yeah, you'll be in our ears again later this week for the final episode, the final real episode of Who Does It Best.
Yeah, that's true. As I'll be talking about something completely different. I'll be talking about drugs policies across Europe. So yeah, please check back our feed on Friday. This episode was reported, written, and produced by me, Wojciech Oleksiak. I co-hosted it with Dominik Kramer, and it was edited by Morgan Childs. Huge thanks to Filip Djordjevic, who was my guide here in Serbia, and to Mila Dragnic, as well as to everyone who found the energy to talk to me before, during, and after the protest. And above all, thank you to all of our supporters. You're the reason we can do this kind of on-the-ground reporting. If you'd like to help us making stories like this, please head to patreon.com/Europeans Podcast and consider becoming a Patreon yourself. This episode was also produced in collaboration with Euronet Plus, the leading radio network for EU news. And also, stay tuned because the situation in Serbia is very dynamic, and I'm already hearing that there are more protests coming in the next few days. Bye!